get underway. I'd like to thank you for all for showing up. There's a lot of things to do today, and it's nice that our old friends have chosen us to spend their afternoon with. Thank you. And we have an hour and a lot of panelists and a lot of memories, so we should get underway. And I'll start down, since he was the first guest at the first mini-con of the first Comic-Con, although we know him more for his association with Jack Kirby, but for Comic-Con, it's literally our first guest, Mike Royer. And next to him is one of America's foremost contemporary illustrators in a variety of pop culture mediums, comics, album covers, movie posters, you name it, with an extreme sidebar expertise in paleontology, and has done fabulous murals in natural history museums around the world, and actually right here in San Diego at the Museum of Natural History features some spectacular examples of William Stout's artwork. And I feel very weird moderating a panel with Mark Evanier on it. I'm truly underqualified to be moderating any panel with this gentleman on it. Also, congratulations to him for his massive, definitive biography of Jack Kirby, which won the Eisner Award last night. Yay! Mr. Mark Evanier. And I don't know, there's some guy that follows Mark around that I guess he's followed him right up onto the stage, but I suppose we ought to let him stay, Sergio Argonis. And next to Sergio, one of our old friends and a funny and talented and witty cartoonist and Renaissance woman, creator of Punch the Girl Blimp, Lee Mars. To my right, a man who is truly one of the iconic figures of Comic-Con, new, old, and in the middle, and probably into the future as well. The great writer of many of your favorite Twilight Zones, of Ocean's 11, of the pilot episode of Star Trek, and much, much more besides, Mr. George Clayton Johnson. Next to George, not only one of the most studied and expert and master practitioners of the comic story format, but also a genuine scholar of the whole thing, and really one of the innovators that has brought us what we know today is the graphic novel with his First Kingdom work, Mr. Jack Katz. The art auction to this event, which probably has saved it at various places along the way, so thanks also to Jack for that. And next to Jack, a comic book writer, in his time with Marvel Comics, one of the formulators of the what we call today the direct sales market or the comic specialty market, really innovating that at a formative stage, doing all sorts of things, including hiring Carol Kalish, but moving on to become one of the first independent publishers and being a leader in terms of not only bringing quality, different kinds of material to the comic book format, but also setting a standard for artist rights and artist ownership of their work, and then going on to become an agent for those same creators with a great deal of success. And now, as he told me the other day, he's been living in another dimension, so we don't know quite what he's been up to, but I'm sure it's very interesting. Mr. Mike Friedrich. I'm David Strogi. I worked on the Comic-Con from 1975 to 1993. And for the last several years, I've been at Dark Horse Comics, making all sorts of weird merchandise.
And now that the introduction's over, I think we have time for about one more question.
Yeah. but we are talking about the El Cortez. We don't really have a topic. I guess our topic is the El Cortez and what came out of that and what it meant to us all in the early days of Comic-Con. We talked about one of the things we touched on at our panel the other day when they asked all the panelists, what did you miss? Is there anything you miss about Comic-Con here now today? And the one thing that came up was the word, the intimacy. And if I could set the bar, the thing about the El Cortez was it was very intimate. There was very little separation between the fans, the pros, the exhibitors, dealers, as we called them then. Some were too, but we're all crowded together in this resort in downtown San Diego, which was actually a pretty funky place to hang out in. And so since this is El Cortez Memories, I thought I'd like to start with so many of us. Hopefully we can keep it down to something manageable. But to start off with just your best memory, your impression of the El Cortez, and what it meant to you and what you might have to share that was probably like a very exceptionally interesting memory. And I guess I'll start with Mike down here.
Well, two outstanding memories are the night standing around the swimming pool with Harlan Ellison and Bill Leibowitz and other celebrities and fans alike and playing movie trivia. And everyone probably remembers that was there the year that the church organization bought the El Cortez, which meant that we couldn't go up to that wonderful lounge at the top of the hotel and imbibe. And at the Masquerade Ball, which was emceed by
Thor.
Gary Owens emceed the masquerade. And it was a presentation made by a group of costume characters, and the audience was not impressed, and they all started to boo. He quickly jumped to his feet. He says, "Remember the new owners, no boos."
That was the thing is, boy, Comic-Con has so little to do with comics now. And at the El Cortez, it was about comics. And you could buy quarter comics and dollar comics and $10 comics and $100 comics. And I miss that. I miss seeing Harrison Ford rummaging around through the boxes of comics for his collection. I miss seeing Leonardo DiCaprio laying on the floor of The Last Gasp for the reading underground comics. There really was an intimacy there. You could meet everyone and anyone, and there was a sweetness to the show. It was a lot more risque back then. There were naked girls in the swimming pools, all kinds of fun. And I dare not tell some of the stories.
Well, one of the nice things about the El Cortez was leaving out the year that the religious group owned it. The people who did own it really didn't care what you did to it. I have to remember all these things that went wrong. I remember the year that the power went out in the dealer's room, and they had to close it one afternoon. And this is a true story. I had to go into the room late at night. They actually closed the dealer's room. Went out like 2 p.m. on Saturday, and it was closed all Saturday night, and reopened finally on Sunday. And dealers were not happy. And they left in the dark. The power went out, and everybody had to stumble out of the dark, and they couldn't bring their stuff out. So they had one guard guarding the room the rest of the day. And at one point, I had to get something that was in the dealer's room. And I went, and the guy with a flashlight took me in, and nobody checked my ID. Nobody asked. I just went up and said, "I want to get something." And he went, "Okay." And we walked through the room, and I had to take stuff out of the room. On the way back, I kicked something on the floor. And I grabbed what it was, and I looked over what it was, and it was a wad of about $9,000 in cash. Someone had dropped there. And I took it out, and I we didn't know where it had come from. Some people had dropped it. And I took it out to Sheldorf. I figured I'd better give this to one person who can take charge of it. I didn't want to be responsible for it. And I gave it to Shell, and Shell said, "I don't want that." And I went around all evening trying to find somebody in authority to give the $9,000. I finally gave it to
Charity,
yes. I think I gave it to Sergio. I finally gave it to the hotel. I finally found the manager of the hotel and gave it to him. He would be responsible. I never found out what happened to that. I remember the year that we were all watching the movie Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. $1,000, and Roger Freeman is nodding vigorously. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, and this is one of the most complicated movies in the history of mankind in the plot, and at 3 in the morning, they're just at the point where the movie's about to end, and they're about to explain the whole plot to people, and all of a sudden, the fire alarm went off. And everybody gets, it's so loud that you can't do the rest of the movie. People laugh, and everybody's coming out of different rooms in different states of dress. Sometimes, in some cases, the rooms they were supposed to be in. And the movie was never finished that night. And the next day, I had to go to the panel. I had to go up and explain the end of Beyond the Veil. And all during the movie, we're sitting there. And this is a movie full of lesbians and sight and such. I'm sitting next to Bob Clampett, and Bob has asked me, why is he doing that? And I go, he's a transvestite. Oh, okay, thank you. And why is he doing that? She's a lesbian. Oh, all right, thank you. And explaining the movie to Bob. I remember Shell calling me one time, giving me the dates of the San Diego convention for the next year. He finally said the dates. I wrote them down. He called me back 3 days later and said, oh, we moved it to the following weekend. And I said, what happened? He said, oh, we found out that that's the year that we have to share that El Cortez with the Miss Nude California pageant. And I thought, you fool! And I'll pass this on. I got about 90 more of these when they come back to me.
So many of them through the years. I remember having an auction by the pool. The auction used to be by the pool, and you sit under these gigantic canvases. And people would see that and start betting. And it was my turn to draw. And I was drawing over there. And next to me was Jack Kirby drawing this amazing Captain America, gigantic one. And people would bid. And I realized that there's nobody around because everybody's in one of the panels or something. So I bet like $50 for the Captain America in color.
Wow.
2 meters by 5 meters or something. And I got it for nothing. So that's one of my priceless treasures of that. But I, so many of them, one of the other stories, mine are so short, so don't worry about it. That singing with Sissy Beck with his guitar all the time by the pool, Mexican songs and all kinds of things, and having a great time. And having Jack Kirby came out of his room and says, guys, please. Because he usually had the room by the pool, who was all like a cabana very nice. He would always come to search you, can you move someplace else? But that was a great memory. But the best one is, one day we're having a great party over there, and these two ladies who used to do a comic book called Clicks and Tits.
Tits and Clits.
Tits and Clits. They go swimming, and they go bare-breasted, you know, and they jump on the pool. And my friend from France, who's never been here, his name was Farshid Baroucha, and he's a publisher artist, and he says, well, we are more civilized than France, you can go naked in the pool. So the guy believes me and takes all his clothes and jumps completely naked on the pool. Well, suddenly, all the lights of the hotel just start lighting. And then, of course, the guards came and they told him to his clothes. I was laughing so hard, the poor guy. We're in France, and this is fine. We're in San Diego, guy. So there's a million of them, too. Please. Go ahead, go ahead.
At a previous con, there was a lot of talk about how there were like 40 people in a room, and you would come back to your room and there would be, you know, people sleeping on the floor, so you'd have to find some place else to sleep. And one of the reasons for this was we couldn't find our rooms. You may remember that the El Cortez was the original Winchester Mystery House. They would have floors that didn't meet other floors, and so the numbers were different on the same floor.
Where they shot me, John Malkovich.
Whoa, it was being possible. So quite a few of those people who were invading other people's rooms just gave up in desperation, and at 1 o'clock would just pick a room and crash there. So that was a kind of time-consuming, fun thing. Those of us who were part of Women's Comics first attended the convention there, and it was really nice. We got a chance to meet the professionals. And they were usually not on the panels. They were usually drunk by the pool. So the good part is that you would get to meet the professionals, but on the other hand, they would be drunk, so they wouldn't remember that they met you. So we quickly learned it wasn't good to leave samples with them or anything responsible. Quite a few of the women cartoonists wore glasses, and there was a tendency to sort of be interchangeable. There would be fans who would think that we were somebody else, or would think there was, you know. So at one point, several of us went into, I of course was not one of the ones, but went into diving off of the second floor of the motel into the pool, of the hotel into the pool. It was probably several drinks into the night at that point. And so when the police were called and they wanted to arrest, you know, whoever was doing this terrible thing, but here were a bunch of damp, bespeckled women. And so, you know, it was kind of like, I'm Spartacus. No, I'm Spartacus. You know, so we avoided major arrest.
That's to George.
I'm George Clayton Johnson. Yay! I'm honored. I really am honored in this, in that I had never expected again in my life to be at a table with these people. Jack Katzer, The First Kingdom, one of the most monumental things that has happened in comic book history. An incredible achievement. 24 books that tell one gigantic story of artwork that's incredible. And then I look down here and I see Mark Evanier, and I remember, my God, who knows more about Jack Kirby than Mark? And who really knows more about fandom? Same thing, I look at Sergio, the fastest cartoonist, hell, just about the best cartoonist. You know, an amazing crowd of heavy-duty folks. And what's incredible about it is when I first met them, they were all young. That was one of the hallmarks of our trick, was that everybody was young. Everybody was accustomed to staying up all night. Dead dog parties that you can't believe. And rough stuff sometimes. I remember one time I went up to that round little bar up above, and there was some people serving drinks up there, and there was a booth, and there in that booth was Johnny Weissmuller. Johnny Weissmuller. And I come up there and I'm dazzled, I'm staring, because my God, there is Tarzan. Now I'll tell you something about myself. Tarzan's real name is John Clayton, Lord Greystoke. Am I not George Clayton, John's son? So I'm staring at Weissmuller, and he disengages himself from the booth. He's drinking and seemingly having a good time, and he comes over toward me, and I put out my hand, because I'm like, God, this is Johnny Weissmuller, and he's getting up and he's coming over, he's going to talk to me, I'm going to greet him. He took my hand with one hand, and he took his other hand, and he put it around behind my neck. And suddenly I realized that Tarzan had me by the goddamn scruff of the neck and could shake me to death if he wanted to, because he said to me, you wouldn't want to hurt me, would you? I thought, what the hell kind of an image do you project, George, that Tarzan sees you as someone who's going to molest him? So I said, oh, Christ, no, Tarzan, I love you. So he let me go and went back to the booth. But I was with Taro. Taro, again, was one of those fans. He was representative of what we have going for us here. Taro, it's very hard to describe almost anyone I ever met at one of these conventions because of their unnatural nature. I mean, William Stahl out here, he knows more about dinosaurs than anybody in the universe, probably. He's drawn them, he's thought about them, he's dissected them, he's cataloged them, he probably has raised a few of them. And yet here I am at a table with him, and I just wanted to say that I really do feel, may I take just another minute? I want to tell you something that we all ought to know. In those days, there was a legendary woman, as we all know, named Bijo Trimble. Good old Bijo, a well-known player, was putting on a bunch of Equicons, which were Star Trek-oriented conventions. As she had just saved Star Trek from extinction, now she was putting on these conventions. And I saw these people flooding into fandom by the thousands. It used to be an incredible thing to get a couple thousand people to come to a hotel to have a convention. Now they were coming by the tens of thousands to these Equicon conventions, and I was the first to raise the cry, de-trembleize now. Whom the gods would destroy, they first trembleize. She's going to grow this thing to a point, because true enough, I went down to this place and I met all of these people who had never read a book. They were viewers, they were not right readers. I questioned a number of them. I couldn't find anybody there that was even close to being literate. And I said, we are doomed. They won't know who Ray Bradbury is. They won't know that's Robert Heinlein. They won't, you know. So I was right. I watched this happen to this convention to the point where enough new comic fans came in. They didn't know who these gentlemen were. They still don't. Tens of thousands of people are wandering around down there who really don't have a single damned idea about what the hell is really going on. They collect the comics, but they don't know who the creators of the comics are. Anyway, I wanted to remark on that.
One of the first conventions I attended, I met my old boss, Jack Kirby, who worked with him in New York City on 59th Street. And from then on, our friendship grew quite a bit. We still have a stay at his house, about 10,000 hours. But I've been toying with the idea of telling this story, because it's almost magical in a sense, and absurd. One of the conventions, Jim Steranko came by. I'm ready to go to sleep. It's 11:30. He says, hey, Jack, what do you say we go out? I said, where do you go? He says, oh, I know a number of places. I said, Jim. He said, no, you're coming. Okay, so we go out. And the first place we went to was a, you know, there's a little pool there. Oh, miniature comic things. And we kept the people up until we went through all 18 homes. We said, okay, fine, let's go back. He said, oh, Jack, what are you talking about? What is it, 132? Come on, there we go. Okay, let's go. Next thing, we went to an arcade, an all-night arcade. And I knew that unless I beat him, we would never go home. And I beat him. And so he said, well, let's try something else. I said, what? He said, to see those carts that go around? He puts on dark glasses. And he looks at me, he puts his finger up, sees that there's some men, and the cart runs the place. He's looking at him strangely. I'm looking at him strangely. We did the carts. I managed to avoid murder. He was so angry. We went to about five other places. It's early, 6 in the morning. And he said, Jack, I want to show you this new book I did. That, it was called, I forget, some detective thing. Yeah, right, right. So he breaks open the doors, we have the guys that are guarding it, and two guys fall out of bed at the door. And he said, it's all right. He says, I'm the author, I'm the author. And then he shows me this stuff by this time. He says, what do you think of this time? I said, the greatest all I've ever seen in my life. Jim Kennedy, go to bed. He said, well, Jack, what do you say we have breakfast? I said, no. That's it, I drove around. He says, well, all right. Said, this, I never thought I would tell this story again. It was so good.
And so we all have to say, you were the worst miniature golf player I ever saw.
I know, I didn't want to say anything. You were with us, and you egged him on. You wouldn't let us, you wouldn't let me go to sleep.
Well, I have another Hallmark story that involves Jack Katz.
Let me.
Hey, Dave, what was the other one? What was the other one?
he invited me to drive down with him to San Diego. See, he's got it, he remembers now. And there were like five of us, six of us, seven of us, I don't know. We were just completely packed into the smallest car I've ever been in. And we started, Jack insisted that we couldn't leave before 11 p.m. because he hated traffic. He just absolutely hated traffic. And so if we were going to get to San Diego, we absolutely had to leave, you know, midnight. And I said, no, if we leave at midnight, we'll run into traffic in San Diego. And he said, oh, okay, well, 11 o'clock then. So sure enough, I mean, he comes by, picks me up, and we're somehow or other, I mean, we're still here, so we must have made it. But I'm afraid I don't remember much more about other than just driving and driving and driving and driving. The other story is, it involves my friend down at the other end here. It wasn't quite at the El Cortez Hotel, it was down the street where I got to watch Mike Royer at the coffee shop get propositioned by a pimp who was trying to get him to hire a professional woman for the evening. And we were a bit younger than Mike at the time, and we aren't now. We've caught up. But, I remember being very much in awe at how Mike gracefully got out of the clutches of this person. Did quite a good job. My life at the El Cortez, of course, was primarily spent in the dealer's room because I was a publisher at that time for most of those years. And to me, the dealer's room was where the real Comic-Con took place. I mean, that was, I didn't have time to go to the panels. I was too exhausted to get drunk and go hang out at the pool. So I was always talking to all of the people that were there selling comics that I was publishing and talking to them about what they wanted to see coming up. And met a lot of very good friends that way. Bud Plant, Bill and Steve Sheamus, Chuck Wozanski, people I remember from that day. And I also very, very clearly remember this little table with this one little sign by it in 1976 announcing this upcoming movie called Star Wars. I mean, Charlie Lippincott had this brilliant idea that comic fans would be people to go to get this movie some buzz. And of course, that's what's led to where we are today. Personally, I think this is great news. I think that we, you know, that good stories are good stories, and visual storytelling is visual storytelling, and I'm really proud that it came out of my field, my industry. And I guess my last thing I want to say is this is my first con in a while. I'm really honored to be a guest here. It's a unique experience for me. I was always working at this show for 35 years, and this is the first show I get to be like everyone else and get to be a fan. And it's really been a lot of fun, and it's great to hang out with y'all.
As Comic-Con has grown to what we have today, you know, sometimes I'll talk to people that haven't been to it and they'll ask me to describe Comic-Con, you know, today, what's it like? And my answer is usually, it's like the parable of the seven blind men describing the elephant. Comic-Con is big and round, and Comic-Con is long and skinny, and Comic-Con has floppy ears, and they're talking about all the different parts of the elephant, because the reason I say that, it's grown so big and so large and over so much territory that there's people that come to this event, have a wonderful time, do lots of things, and you know what? They didn't do one thing that I did. They didn't see one thing that I saw. We might as well have been at different events for all the commonality between our experiences. But if you were to continue that parable of the Comic-Con being the elephant and people seeing these describing these different parts of it, there's one part of it that I think is sitting here right in this room, and that's the heart. And they always told me, my dad used to always say, you know, the devil's in your head and God's in your heart, and sometimes it's a long way between the two. But I think that one of the things us old-timers feel is that, because we weren't motivated by money much, well, most of us anyway, and we were doing it out of love. Certainly no one was getting paid, not too many people were taking home a lot of dough either. And I'd say this crowd here, certainly up here at the table, and I think most of you here in the room might feel the same way. So if I had a short question, because there's so many years of memories and so much of it sitting right here, that maybe if you could each talk a short incident that showed Comic-Con's heart to you from those days.
Well, in the early days, one of the neat things at the El Cortez was the banquet and the Inkpot Awards. And awards are an interesting thing, because in those days you would honor someone from this period and another period several decades later. And a personal memory that I'll always have is standing in a doorway at 2 a.m. in the morning, going into one of the wild parties, and feeling this hand on my shoulder and turning around and having Vern Hogarth look at me and say, "We got ours, kid." And I'm like, I'm this little insignificant cog in this giant icon of another day, and "We got ours, kid." We both got ink pots that year. Well, you think about my previous story? No, it's so funny to be at the banquet, get an ink pot, at the same time that Vern Hogarth, who was one of my childhood gods, and the decades between the beginning of my career and the peak of his, and then that we got ours, kid. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
That's a very fond memory.
Along a similar line, is the first time I met Will Eisner and showed him my work. And he looked at me, he was very appreciative, and he said, "Don't stop doing the funny stuff. I love that there is humor in your work." And I've always taken that with me. I've always continued to do funny stuff. And I realized that he was one of those rare cartoonists who straddled the line and could do serious stuff that was also funny. And I tried to straddle that same line. But when I received my Ink Pot Award, I got the most unbelievably awesome introduction from Jim Storenko. And I'll never forget it. And in fact, he gave me the cards that he had written for my introduction. I've still got them to this day. Really, really touching and really
honest. A lot of choices here. I used to think that awards were very stupid. And oddly enough, I think I suggested the Ink Pot Awards and then regretted it for a while. I think I told Shell the idea one time. I know I suggested the Bob Clampett Humanitarian Award. That was my suggestion. I think I'm way home from Bob's funeral, I drove Shell. At some point, I thought how silly awards were. And the Ink Pots were being given out, I thought, for a couple of years there, really foolish. It's like anybody, you know, saying, "Oh, okay, thank you, here's your program book, here's your badge, here's your Ink Pot Award." And I thought they were like really cheapening them and making them into something really, becoming a joke. So one year, a man named Mike Sikowski came to the convention. Now, for those of you who don't know, Mike was a comic book artist for many years. He was maybe the fastest artist who ever lived.
Yeah,
he was probably faster than Serge. I didn't say better than Serge.
He's there.
Okay. Yeah, he's dead. It's okay. So, and Mike had been treated very, very badly by the comic book business in New York. He'd been fired, he'd been humiliated. There are certain stories. We all know the sad stories of the Siegel and Schusters and people like that. But there's lesser tragedies of the comic book business. And Mike had kind of been banned from the industry in New York. He'd come out to LA. He'd gotten to work at Hanna-Barbera. And we dragged him down one year to the San Diego Con because he was going to get an Ink Pot Award. He did not know this. And it happened to be the same year that Julius Schwartz got his Ink Pot, Mike's old editor on Justice League of America. And Mike wasn't even going to come to the ceremony, and I dragged him to the thing. He was this old curmudgeonly alcoholic, couldn't get along with anybody guy. And we were in the back, and kept wanting to leave the ink pots, and I kept going, no, stick around, there's something interesting happening later, Mike, okay. So finally, they announced that they were giving the award to this man, he worked in comics for many years, and he drew the Justice League of America for years, and suddenly Mike goes, wait a minute, I drew this for years? The only other guy who did it was Dick Dillon, and he's not here. And they said, he drew Wonder Woman, and he drew the Inferior Five. He did this, and I could see Mike was like starting to tear up a tiny bit. And he brushed it aside when his name was called. He went to the stage, and he got the ink pot and mumbled out something about how wonderful it was to him. And on his way back, he passed Julius Schwartz, and he turned to him and said, "My price has just gone up." Meant a lot to him, and at that point I stopped mocking the ink pots, and there were later certain people who got them, and it was the only award they ever got in their life. People of that generation, they were honored by it. It meant a lot to them. We had a couple years left in this building. A man named Fred Gardiner, who got an ink pot, who had created Zatara the Magician, and had been forgotten, had not been around comics for 25 years. It's like that he had not had any contact with anybody in comics, and he came to the convention. Somebody, a fan found Dave Siegel, found him in a nursing home in Northern California, brought him down here, and he brought his family down, and he got the only award of his life, the only recognition. And Fred was in a wheelchair, and I remember when I presented the ink pot to him. At the Golden Age panel, he wanted to get up and make a speech. I said, "You can stand in a wheelchair." He goes, "No, I'm standing up for this." He stood up once a year at that point. His health was so bad. And he stood up, and I'm holding him by the back of his pants because he's shaking. He wanted to stand up, and he made this wonderful, touching speech. His family was all crying and such. And it was one of the most important moments of this man's life. He died about 2 years later. But this convention gave him a recognition. And this is the only convention to this day where people are honored and are brought out and get the trips and the suite and the perks and such, even if they're not name draws who will draw people in. A year or two ago we had a man named Tom Gill out here. Tom Gill, I did the spotlight on him. I think we had 11 people in the room. Nobody came to the convention to see Tom Gill. He wasn't like, you know, let's get Frank Miller here and it'll fill the hall. But the convention brought him out and paid for him, and Tom Gill had the thrill of meeting old friends and having people worship his work and tell him that he got an Inkpot Award. And that's what I think the heart of the convention is, that it has rewarded that generation that didn't get rewarded the way some of us who were born later did. That's my opinion.
One short story. A few years ago at Comic-Con, there was a celebration of DC Comics. It was probably the last major gathering of all the living DC artists. And I think we all knew that it was going to be. It was just extraordinary. And I was assigned the task of caretaking Willie Elder, who I had worked with on Little Land of Candy. When I was working on Andy Fanny, Willie was very fatherly toward me and really showed me the ropes and taught me a lot of things. And he was just the sweetest, kindest guy. And at Comic-Con, I brought Willie to the banquet, and at a certain point, he wanted to get second, so he was very frail at the time, and so I was helping him across the floor to get to the table to get some more food. And suddenly he stopped and he looked up at me and said, "Phil, now you're my father."
When he was talking about the inputs, they are so important and really the soul, as Mark said, because today I had the honor to give one to Ramon Valdiosera, which is one of the men that created the comic book industry in Mexico. He's 92 years old. And he was invited by the con, and he's sensational because for him this was the best thing that ever happened to him. And being 92, he came all the way from Mexico. Well, he collapsed at before the con, the panel, and I arrive and I'm sitting there, and a lady came and says, just collapsed below, so we don't know this with the paramedics. So I start talking about him, about his life, how he created the comic book industry in Mexico and everything. And suddenly the door opened, and he comes, being put, being taken by these people because he didn't want to miss his panel. He didn't want to be taken to the hospital. Mm-hmm. So he sat in the chair. I talked about him. We took the microphone, and when I gave him the input award, for first time in English, he said that he wanted to thank that Comic-Con because it was the most important day of his life. It's true. But the best moment for me is getting blotto with Cleveland, in a bar. We lost him too young, too. And then getting blotto with Wally Wood, we lost also. Very young. So it's all these chances to that we met our heroes, that they became our friends, that we had a chance to drink with them, and that give them an award to a man that I grew up with, and another man that I grew up with, that I'm in the elevator with him, and I don't know how he looks like, because I knew his work. And I spent the whole elevator going down with him, and I didn't even say hello to him. I was only wearing the elevator with Will Eisner. I didn't say hello to him or anything. Yeah. But then we became very good friends. It's these things. It's the other cartoonists, your teachers, your masters that you meet, and then your colleagues. And now I see it continuing, because now kids come to me like trembling, you know, because they grew up with my work. And probably the con will be for so long that they are going to get old, and somebody's going to get it.
After coming a couple of times, I realized the real value of how 5 minutes of how the honoring that the convention did, because our field only in the last about 10, maybe 5 years has gotten any respect at all. So a lot of the original people who worked in the field were doing just trash work, or were doing grunt work, or were doing hack work. They were doing valuable work. But as far as, you know, anybody was concerned, you know, some of the artists had kind of had covers for what they were really doing. They said they were medical illustrators, or that, you know, they had different stories. I really appreciate that, and I think that the fact that that this convention would recognize them is really has always been the heart of the convention.
I'll just say something real quick on the note that kind of we're following. When I first started on the convention, it was all new to me. Sheldorf told me something about the convention. I'm sure he said it a lot. And it's absolutely not true today. It's one of the things that I think are different today. But he said, look at these cartoonists, these great entertainers, that millions of people look at their work and are entertained by it. And these are the only entertainers that never get to hear the applause of their audience. And Comic-Con gives them that opportunity. And that was really a true statement at the time. George.
Thank you. One of my greatest trophies, things that I own, is a plaque in my workroom that announces that I'm a friend of fandom. I've won that Friend of Fandom award. Well, it's so such a lift to me, because I truly am a friend of fandom. As a matter of fact, I owe an allegiance to fandom that probably, I mean, it's extraordinary in that fans are the only leaderless society that I know of.
How about Democrats?
We have. Most of the people who are the secret masters of fandom will never tell us they are the secret masters, or it will not be a secret. But whoever is running this, we don't have any grand poobah, we don't have any czar, but by some common thing having to do with Robert's Rules of Order, we know that every 4 years we got to give this way to some, this world convention away to some foreigners. I mean, for God's sakes, what is all of this? Fandom gave us the Amateur Press Association, which turned many a grubby, ink-stained wretch into a member of the they were, suddenly became reporters. Why? Because they turned out 2 pages of prose every 6 months or something and published it in at least 60 copies. Fanzine. But out of the fanzine came the APAs, the Amateur Press Associations. Out of fandom came the idea that we could have a common goal, a series of common overlapping goals, without having a leader, nobody to call the shots or to say we can't do this or we can't do that. We stretched it out in diplomatic discussion. I mean, read some of the stories about the early days of fandom, The Immortal Storm by Moskowitz or whatever. Incredible, 13 pimply youths in a downtown New York hotel fought it out over a period of about 18 years or something to establish where we were going to hold the Northeast Con or the Western Con or the Ozark Con or what the, and how, who was going to do it and how they were going to do it. And then the volunteers on the panel the other night, I listened to a bunch of people who had started with this convention as basically volunteer grunt labor just to help Shell and a handful of other people. I was drug into it by a magician named Patrick Culleton. This whole affair of fandom per se attracted my attention so much that I've gone to at least 3 to 6 conventions per year for almost 50 years. This convention, I've gone to maybe 35 of them out of the 40 that are out here. I owe a devotion to fans, and I truly am a friend of fans. If you are a science fiction fan, you can have my attention, you know. That's because of the importance I place on the whole idea of communications. I will make one final remark. Here it is. My greatest day at this convention, I think, Sergio talked about holding auctions, art auctions, out by the swimming pool at the El Cortez. Well, the swimming pool was flanked by a bunch of cabana-type little apartments, and all these apartments cost a lot more because they opened onto the pool. One morning, I came down, I found they had set up a portable kitchen. They were feeding everybody breakfast by the pool. I mean, this went on for hours, nourishing bacon and eggs and all that stuff, and there was a frantic amount of free food for the convention goers done by the committee and by others around there. But I was astonished to see that nobody was charging any money for this thing, and I decided, these are my people.
Do not separate. We have to stop immediately. But just two quick non-sequiturs. Number one, stay so young. What are you doing? Tell us your secret, my God. That's number one. Number two, Lloyd Greystoke was not his real name. For those of you who read the first book by Edgar Rice Burroughs, his name was held in the veins because they didn't want to consult the colonials of Great Britain. So we would never know. His name could be Hyman Heinrichs.
Do you got a real quick one, Mike? Is there a round of time?
I used to run conventions. I believe in meeting deadlines. Let's go.
Okay, I have one last thing to say. I think I can speak for all the panelists here. I hope so. Because of all of us together, there's a lot of conventions, that's for sure. And there are many, many special moments in these conventions, and you've heard a few of them. But I would bet I can say that of all the moments for all of us at all the Comic-Cons, this moment, right here, right now, is the most recent.